Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, what's up? This is Seth Green, and you are listening to Somewhere in Vegas with Mark, and I am so hot, I would desperately like a glass of water. Please, please, give me some water.
This is Cindy Preston, and I'm with Mark on Somewhere in Vegas.
Hi, this is Melissa Peterman from CMT's The Singing Bee and the television show Reba, and I have to tell you, I just have to get it off my chest, I love Somewhere in Vegas with Mark.
Hi there. This is Faith Roscoe from General Hospital. You're listening to Mark on Somewhere in Vegas. And you better watch out. We know how to find you if you're not listening.
Hi, this is Shannon Egan from Whippet, and I love Somewhere in Vegas with Mark.
Hey, this is Lee Allen Baker with Somewhere in Vegas, talking with Mark with a Q.
This is Courtney Cronin. You're listening to Somewhere in Vegas with your host, Mark, and I would make sure to listen every week because he's a sure bet.
Hey, this is the Money Man, Eddie Money. I got two tickets to Paradise, and it's, you know what? It's Somewhere in Vegas. And what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Hi, this is Crystal Kale, and I love Somewhere in Vegas with Mark.
Hi, this is Terry Nunn from Berlin, and you're listening to Mark Somewhere in Vegas.
Hi, this is Miracle Laurie from Joss Whedon's Dollhouse. There are three flowers in a vase, and I'm listening to Somewhere in Vegas with Mark.
Hi, this is Erin Hill, and you are listening to Mark on Blog Talk Radio and Somewhere in Vegas. Mark is a great guy.
Hi, this is Sean Pulaski. I'm still trying to figure out Mark Pico's sexuality, but I know you're listening to Somewhere Live in Vegas.
Here you go, Mark. I'm sorry. I thought you were she. I'm sorry. Get out of the tent. Let's get out of here.
Hey, this is Lance and Anna from Free Radio. And Anna?
And you're listening to Somewhere in Vegas.
Yes.
My favorite.
You know, that's usually what happens with me. I go to Vegas and I get lost, and so I end up somewhere in Vegas.
Somewhere in Vegas.
But right. I just don't know where it is.
Not quite sure.
Yeah, word.
Get ready. It's going to be hot. It's in Vegas. Check out Mark. Be there or be square.
Welcome, everybody, to Somewhere in Vegas here on blogtalkradio.com, also vegaspodcasting.com. I'm Mark the Q. I'm your host. Coming up at the top of the hour, we're going to have author Patricia Reed, who wrote a really great book called Flying with the Rich and Famous. We're talking to her about some of the stories she had up in the wild blue yonder, as it were, and that'll be at the top, bottom of this hour, I should say. It'll be at the bottom of the hour. We'll be talking to her. It's going to be a crazy kind of couple of weeks, but I figured I'd kick off the show with a little bit of a throwback interview. As everybody knows, Deadpool's coming out this week. I think a lot of us are excited to go watch it. But I was lucky enough to be able to get an interview, I think it was about a year or two ago, with T.J. Miller, absolutely funny, hilarious stand-up comedian. Since then, he was in Transformers. He's been in a lot of big roles as of late. Now he's going to be in Deadpool, a very big part of Deadpool, actually. So it's going to be great to be able to see him live on the screen. But we had him basically when he was still doing stand-up. I think he still does stand-up once in a while, so it'll be interesting to see if he still does this. But he's made a mark for himself on television and movies alike. Doing very successful for himself. So I figured I'd throw us back for a couple years back with this interview. Like I said, TJ is a really great guy. He was going to be performing in Vegas when I interviewed him, and we just talked a little bit about his booming acting career and what was going on in his life back then. So here's our throwback interview with Deadpool star TJ Miller. Hello.
Hey, Mark.
Oh, hey, TJ. How's everything going?
Hey, how are you?
Congratulations on your outstanding acting career. I really enjoyed you, and She's Out of My League. I thought that was a really breakout performance for you.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Now, how did you get started in comedy?
Well, first of all, have you seen Yogi Bear in 3D?
I have not seen it in 3D, but I have seen it on cable.
Thank God. Okay, well, as long as you've seen that, then I feel you really know me as a performer.
Well, to be acting with some bears, like animated bears like that, that says a lot.
I mean, thank you so much. That's what I was looking for. That's all. You know, I have to really feel that before, you know, before I do any publicity. Yeah, so I started in comedy as, you know, as an improviser and a sketch comedian in Chicago.
Now, I talked to comedians before, and they talk a little bit about doing comedy versus doing improv. And, you know, basically, stand-up's a little bit more without a net. You know, you don't have anybody to kind of back you up on it as well. Versus an improv group where you kind of feed off each other, and there's a little bit more different kind of mentality when you go into stand-up versus going into improv. Is there any one that you prefer better, stand-up or improv?
No, not really. You know, I always tell people that I, you know, I just like comedy. Because it is. People sort of, you know, it's interesting. It's all sort of acting also, all of it feels kind of just like different mediums of comedy. And so, I you know, stand-up to me is more challenging, I think, than any of them because you're sort of doing everything. But by the same vein, you know, I love improvising, and I think that's a challenge to collaborate with people and sort of, you know, make it up as you go along and constantly changing. And, you know, there's no net there either because you don't have anything scripted beforehand. So I like it all, and they each have their own challenges. But my favorite is, like, I guess, sort of interpretive dance. That's my favorite type of comedy.
Yeah,
I'll wear a leotard. Usually it's sequined. In fact, you know what? It's always sequined. I'd make you put that in the article. It's always sequined. I'll wear a leotard, and then I'll just sort of, you know, I'll kind of dance my heart out, and that's my favorite type of comedy.
Yeah, I mean, you think a lot on your feet when it comes to comedians, and I also hear that that's very helpful when you take improv because then you can be able to think in your feet real quick about what's going on because you have to kind of tell with your audience, you know, if you have them, you know, in your pocket or you're absolutely failing absolutely miserably.
Right, exactly. And stand-up, it's hard when it's just you and you are failing miserably, which happens more than you could imagine.
well, that brings me to my next question. You've obviously bombed in the past, if you were saying that. And have you learned from your experiences of bombing in front of audiences?
Yeah, I mean, you know, don't get angry, I think. It's not anybody's fault. You know, it's not technically the audience's fault because they just aren't into your sensibility and they as a group have assembled together. Kind of bad luck. You know, it just happens to be a group of people that doesn't gel into a cohesive, positive audience. And, you know, and then it's also not the performer's fault because he's obviously trying his best. He's there to ruin people's nights, that ruins his also. But just sort of, you know, it's no one's fault. It's painful for everybody, painful for the comedians, painful for the audience. And the best thing to do is slowly take off your clothes from a performer standpoint. Just slowly take off each piece of clothing until you're nude and cry.
Yeah, and, you know, when it comes to, you know, acting versus doing comedy, there's this a certain kind of, you know, when you're doing stand-up comedy, there is a kind of almost instant gratification, I think, when it comes to stage versus having to be in front of a camera. You may have a bigger, you know, more of an intimate audience, I guess, with stand-up. And I know they're two different things, and you probably enjoy doing both, but, you know, can you tell us a little bit about that, the idea of maybe some of that little instant gratification that you get when you're on stage and you really got a crowd going?
Anytime when I'm improvising as a stand-up is pretty... That's just about the sweetest version of the drug that is laughter that I can kind of relate to. When I'm sort of riffing, and it's entirely within, it's just the audience and me, that's a very specific, incredible sort of feeling. Because, and not just for me, for the audience, too, because you're sort of, it's improvising, but instead of other improvisers on stage, your other improviser is this audience. And so my interaction with them then builds kind of stream of consciousness stuff, and I'll discover things and make fun of myself for not discovering others. And all of that is being discovered by the audience and me. So, and it's a little hippy-dippy, but I am wearing a lot of patchouli oil. And when I say a lot, I mean more than usual, which is a lot.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the comic chops would be improv, you know, works in a lot with your acting as well, because, I mean, I'm pretty sure you have some, depending on the film, some leeway in which you can use some of those improv skills.
Yeah, I mean, I studied a little bit as an actor, because I think you have to have that skill set, too. You know, I mostly acted as trees and background objects in most of William Shakespeare's plays throughout middle school, junior high, and high school. But I feel like I learned a lot from that, especially my role as Pretty in Twelfth Night. If you have me as an actor in your film or on television, you're going to expect that I'm an improviser. I've been lucky to get to a point where people sort of understand that and are okay with it, and they realize that they're sort of bringing an improviser on set. So I'm going to be improvising a lot of the lines, and it's really fun to, you know, to have that freedom. So I feel like I do the best in those types of movies, like She's Out of My League, where I was able to improvise a lot, and there was a lot of funny stuff in the script as well. You know, and then to riff a line from Cloverfield or She's Out of My League that someone says, oh, I love that line, it's so funny, I always think of it. Like, hey, I made that up, you know. That'll be really, really nice. And then other times I'll say, you know, I made up this line, who brought the good news, Bear, you know. And they'll say, I hated that line, I didn't like that. And I say, well, I'm so sorry, you know, I improvised it. And they go, well, don't say it again, and don't say it around me, please. So it's, you know, it's still fun. It's fun to do.
Yeah, I mean, have you thought about maybe, you know, writing your own script and producing your own film sometime down the line?
Yeah, I would love to. I mean, I did these two films that went to Sundance. They're short films, Successful Alcoholics and Difficult Time Killing My Parents, which you can see both of those on Funny or Die. And so I'd love to at some point produce my own film that I wrote, because I've written some things, you know, that people have sort of enjoyed in the short film category. So I'd love to do a feature film, but that's hard. You know, you got to take time to craft a really good feature film. There's a lot more money at stake. So I think that's down the line, but it's going to require a lot of work beforehand.
Now you were a voice in How to Train Your Dragon, and by sounds of it, there is a sequel coming out on that as well. Have you started doing any of the voiceovers yet for that film?
Yeah, I have. We did our first round a little while ago, and you know, there'll be more to be done. It won't come out until 2014, I don't think. So these things take a while to craft and put together. But yeah, I've done a little bit, and I tried to bring a different voice. I tried to do sort of a, whoa, what are we doing with all these dragons? You know, but they didn't like that, so I was doing the original voice from the original in the sequel.
Well, again, that's something that, you know, you get to probably do a lot more improvising once in a while in the booth as well. And, you know, and it's just you in the booth, though. And, you know, and do you guys do sessions where there are actors that play off each other during a scene, or is it just you in the booth doing the voiceover?
We have, yeah. You know, I've worked with Kristen Wiig directly on a couple sessions, and that was really fun, but a lot of times with people scheduled and they live in different places, they sort of just have to do your part, and you know, you'll listen to other people's performances or give them enough variety that they can piece it together. But it's really it's one of the most sort of complicated and beautiful jigsaw puzzles there exists in film and cinema, except for maybe the rom-com that's a bromance about where the car went to. You know, like, dude, where's my car?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of fun to you know, to be able to play around with a lot of improv actors like Kristen Wiig, who you know, do have improv experience, to kind of play off of them as well, and be in the same kind of almost the same mindset between yourself and some of the actors that you've worked with as well. Is it easier the second time around to be able to do a voice like that?
I think, yeah, you already have the firm basis of your character. So, yeah, it's a little bit easier. It's harder because you can't use the same tricks you used the first time around. So it's sort of a bittersweet symphony, like that song by Verve.
Yeah, the one that they don't own.
Right. Oh, it's so sad.
Yeah. With a lot of your comedy on stage, on stage as stand-up, how much of that is material that you've pre-written, and how much of that is just kind of improv off of the cuff?
Well, it sort of depends. Usually it's about 50-50, but it depends on what I'm working on. You know, I just did this Comedy Central series mashup where I had to build very quickly 40 minutes of TV-ready material for these 8 episodes. And so, unfortunately, then I wasn't doing much improv whenever I performed, because I had to sort of get these jokes right and get them to the point where they could be presented on national television. I only had a couple months to do it. But, you know, my ideal situation, and when I come to Vegas, it'll be sort of, you know, 50% material and 50% improvising.
Yeah, I know.
And some of that is trying new material for the first time, but most of it is just interacting with the audience.
I know that Louis C.K. had actually said that, you know, he's sometimes excited about the idea of having to be on a little bit of a deadline, because you know that you have to have some new material out there, because if, you know, if something comes up, because if you go into a television special and you do the same stuff that you do on stage, it's going to be outdated once the special comes out, and you have to think of more new stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Sometimes he attributes it to that. I think he sort of set a goal where he has a new hour of material each year, and that's insane. It's a very, very crazy pace to work at, but I've sort of thrown myself into that lion's lair, and I'm kind of, you know, having to do that right now. But for me, stand-up is more enjoyable when you can take the time to improvise and make each performance should simultaneously be about generating a new television special or album or more content, you know, for TV and media. But it should also be about the night, you know, and about those people that came to see you. And for me, that's most clearly represented in riffing with the audience.
Yeah, and it's going to be great to see you here in Vegas at the Empire. And you know, I mean, a lot of comedians once they turn to acting and have an successful career like yourself, leave the stage for a while, and they don't do anything on stage as much. And it's kind of interesting to see that a guy like yourself does do stand-up still, even though that, you know, you could be relaxing on the beach or doing something else with, you know, on that as well.
I am in the desert hot springs right now, a weird story as we talk. But, yes, you're right, and the reason is because acting will turn its back on you at any moment, and stand-up will never.
Wow, love that quote.
That's true. Statement.
Yeah, I mean, that's a gem right there. I'll have to remember that one. We got your gigs coming up this week over at the Empire. And anything else coming up for you?
Yeah, well, I have a podcast on Nerdist and on iTunes called Cashing In with TJ Miller, and it's an interview show, you know, like a lot of these comedy podcasts are, but. In this case, Cash Levy, the host, can only really get me as a guest because no one else really wants to do his show. So it's sort of an interview show, but I'm the same guest. It's just me as the guest over and over. So that's a lot of fun. You got to hear it. And Mashup is the series on Comedy Central that I hosted and executive produced. And that's coming out probably in November, sometime sort of in the fall, winter. And then I'm in Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, which is a movie with Steve Carell and Keira Knightley. And I'm also in Rock of Ages, talking on the phone to Tom Cruise, only for a little while, but still, something to hang my hat on, which is actually one of those Viking helmets. And that's Rock of Ages, and that'll be out, I think, also in the summer. And then, I think that's pretty much it. You know, come see me live, because that's so fun, to see me live at the stand-up. Yeah.
Yeah, it must have been very interesting to work with Steve Carell and Keira Knightley on a set. You know, Steve actually has pretty good improv acting chops there.
Oh, yeah, he was the Second City main stager, so he's for real. And, you know, yeah, he was great. And so is Keira Knightley. She was great. She ran with the improv pretty well. But, yeah, Steve Carell is a gifted improviser, to be sure. Oh, and also, I have an album, the Extended Play EP, which is available on Comedy Central Records. And then also in September, but out pretty soon, is going to be the remix of that album by Illegal Art, which is the label that carries Girl Talk and Steinsky. And Steinsky does a mega mix on the Illegal Art remix tape of the Extended Play EP. So check out those two music albums that I made for absolutely no reason at all. I'm not a musician. I don't intend to be, you know?
Yeah, you're
it's all about
you're
merchandise in America. You know, it's about merchandising and brand recognition.
I was going to say, your actual strength is in interpretive dance, so.
I mean, that's exactly it. So I'm trying to make the music to dance to. Please won't you buy it. That should be the final quote. I'm trying to make the music that I can dance to. Please won't you buy it.
Yeah, I also want to mention that you can follow T.J. Miller on Twitter, at not T.J. Miller.
Yeah, it gets real weird on there. Yeah, it gets real weird on there.
Yeah, so at not T.J. Miller. I want to make sure you guys get that
right.
Because
at T.J. Miller, at T.J. Miller is taken by a woman in Pennsylvania who's tweeted literally 7 or 8 times since 2007. It's ridiculous. It's very frustrating. So it's at not T.J. Miller.
And also the website, nottjmiller.com as well.
It's TJ. It's actually TJ Miller does not have a website.com.
Right,
it's even more complicated. TJ Miller does not have a website.com. That's Flash right now, but we're getting that updated to HTML, so we're going to kind of go back in time.
Well,
it'll be iOS ready.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely as well. And, TJ, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Best of luck to you, you know, coming up this weekend here in Vegas. And I really look forward to seeing some of the films come out. And like I said, your career has just been absolutely outstanding, you know,
it's
as a comedian. And it's great to keep kind of grounded here on stand-up stage.
It's because of you, you know, and not your listeners or your audience, you specifically. It's because of you that I do comedy, you know, and I'm able to have this great career. So if you keep, you know, if you don't die, just take care of yourself, because I'm doing it for you. And if you were to be hurt or we lost you, I would just stop doing comedy. That's true. So I do it for you, not the general sense, you specifically.
Well, I very appreciate that, TJ. And like I said, best of luck to you. Hopefully you can get past the desert and come to the nice oasis that is Las Vegas in just a little while.
Sorry, well, I'm going by foot, so that's why I'm in the desert, and I'm sorry about the reception. We'll talk soon.
Oh, definitely, TJ. Thanks a lot for being on the show.
I'll see you soon. I'm walking
to you. Soon.
All right, I'm walking.
That was TJ Miller. You guys can check him out in the movie Deadpool, opening up this week at the Yolico Theater, so definitely check him out as well. Like I said, he just absolutely has a solid resume of movies that he's done, and I look forward to seeing what he does over the next year, and I'm glad he does stand-up still. I'll have to take a look and see if he does any stand-up. Maybe we'll get TJ back on again. But really nice guy, really hilarious, and really really insightful guy in terms of talking about comedy. So it's great to be able to have him on the show. And I believe, like I said, that was a couple years ago. I think that was before, How to Train Your Dragon 2. So that's quite a couple years ago, I think, that he came on the show. So great to be able to talk to him about what he's been doing and up to back then. And it's great to catch up with him as well. I'm going to do is going to play a little music because we've got a little bit of time. We've got about 5 minutes until my guest arrives. So we're going to see if we'll play some music here. Let's see what I want to play. I need to upload some of my stuff from one of my guests that I've had on the show because she sent me some stuff. I should probably upload one of them for that. But I will do that later. What do I want to play? Let us play. We will play. I think we'll play some Erin O'Brien, a little superstar, I think. And then when we get back, we should be live with Patricia Reed, talking about her book, Flying with the Rich and Famous. So here's a little bit of Erin O'Brien, little superstar, and we'll be back with our guest. Okay, everybody, I think our guest is on the line with us. She is the author of the book Flying with the Rich and Famous. You can get that over on Amazon.com as we speak. I believe Patricia Reed is on with us right now. Are you there, Patricia?
I am here. Thank you for having me.
Not a problem at all. First of all, how's it been going so far with the book?
It's actually going really well. It's a genre that's never been done. No one knows what goes on up there, you know, in the air up there. So it's a first time ever told story, and people want to know.
Yeah. Now, tell me a little bit about how you got started in terms of becoming a flight attendant.
Well, okay, so originally I was just a little girl, and my dad had a little Bonanza, and he liked to go flying on Saturdays, and since I was the youngest girl, I ended up going with him, because I was like, you know, dad's little shadow, and I started, you know, flying over to Catalina, and then over Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm here in Southern California, and I just thought it was a blast. You know, sometimes we'd do crazy eights, and we'd run a different airplane, do crazy eights, and go upside down, which I just loved. So it started my love of aviation. So I made it my goal to get, I wanted to be a flight attendant on for the airlines. But that's not how everything turned out. So I ended up going to flight service classes at a community college. I got plucked out of there and was a ticket agent for Jet America, who, while I was with Jet America, who is now Alaska, actually, a man came through my line and asked me if I wanted to fly on a new airline that was first class service only, and it was LAX to New York. Well, this was the most opulent airplane I have ever seen in my life. To this day, it's still the most opulent airplane I ever flew. So we flew rock stars and television stars and singers and songwriters and divas and politicians and sports figures and stockbrokers. And, I mean, every flight was an adventure with the rich and famous. And I could not wait to get on that plane because it was the 80s and it was crazy. You know, we had private staterooms in the back and, you know, like, I'd have all these famous people hiding back there from the people in the front. And but it was just crazy. It was faux china, baccarat, crystal, and Tattinger champagne. We had a bar. We had a bar car, which is where Jack Nicholson always sat. And then we had the staterooms, which there was always something going on back there. And then the party was kind of in the front. And anyways, they didn't charge enough money for their tickets because they were trying to compete with American and TWA, which, of course, they had a lot less people on the plane, so they needed to charge a lot more money, which they didn't do. So they went bankrupt. And from there, I decided to go in search of these private jets that I had heard the passengers talk about on Regent Air, was the name of that first-class-only airline. And because I didn't know there were private jets. I'm like, there's private jets out there? Most people don't know their existence. I mean, they're much more mainstream now because they're on the TV show Criminal Minds, and they were written about in 50 Shades of Grey and her trilogy. And, you know, people are more aware of them. But at that time, nobody was. So I started knocking on doors, and I got on my first private jet, and I didn't have any idea what I was doing. And I flew the junk bond king, Michael Milken, and I was scared to death and a nervous wreck. But I pulled it off. And from there, I flew for sports teams, corporate companies, owner-operated companies, jet charter companies, everybody. I flew for so many people, I was never home. So it was a wild career that I had no idea it would take me in that direction.
Now the Regent Airlines one, was that a red eye flight or was that anytime?
No, it was two daily flights, like one at 8 a.m. and one at like 5 p.m. something like that, to Newark, New Jersey, because you know you can't really get into, or maybe they didn't have the money, I don't know, to get into the LaGuardia or JFK. So we went to Newark and, you know, they all had limousines. That was the other thing. They had limousines that came that would pick them up in L.A. and take them right out to the tarmac at the airport at LAX, because it was on the other side. It was on the Imperial side of LAX, not the mainstream side. So it was all private. So the limousines would drive right up to the aircraft, which was a 727, and load their baggage right onto the airplane, and they get out of their limo and walk right up the stairs onto the plane. And the same thing happened when we landed in Newark. So, you know, it was quite a novelty. It was a great idea at the time, had they done the math correctly.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those situations where, I mean, that's very atypical now. I mean, you know, back in the 80s, I think it was somewhat atypical. Like you said, it probably wasn't as well known as it is now, but you know, a lot of these celebrities go between LA and New York, especially if they have to do talk shows or whatever. If they promote something, they have to go to the East Coast in order to hit those late night shows back then, because Letterman was out there and all that. So they had to kind of do that red eye thing where they'll go to New York, do all this publication, come back to LA, you know, or vice versa. They're in New York, they're filming something, but they have to go to L.A. to see, you know, be part of Johnny Carson or Jay Leno, and then go there and then come back.
Oh, for sure.
So,
I
yeah,
mean,
I'm
they
film that
all the time. That's what they do. They go back and forth, L.A. to New York, with all celebrities.
Yeah, I mean, and that makes sense. It makes a lot of sense at all.
Yeah,
in terms of that as well. And now, I mean, there's also that convenience now of, because I think I saw somewhere, I think it was TMZ or something, or some article the other day that they talked about a separate terminal or a separate place for celebrities now at LAX because they don't want to be bothered or whatever. I'm assuming that with Regent, it's a lot. It was relatively the same thing where they not only the convenience of their being an airline only catered to the kind of the first class, but also the fact that their terminal probably was a little bit more private than a lot of the other ones were.
Oh, way private. It wasn't even in the normal terminal. It was on the other side, and nobody uses that runway but, like, the cargo planes. So it was way to the south of LAX. But with these celebrities nowadays, though, they're still going to have to get on American and Delta, so they may get in out of the car and into the airport another way, but they still have to go through the crowds to get to their airplane unless they're taking a private jet, which, you know, most of the mainstream people, the big guns are on private jets. They won't fly commercially because, you know, they're retired.
I mean, you'd be surprised. Yeah, you'd be surprised. Actually, I remember a story about Anthony Hopkins, and I think he was I think he was dating Martha Stewart at the time. I think if I remember correctly, and Martha had bought him a first class ticket. Well, Anthony Hopkins, being the Scrooge that he is, traded in his first class ticket for a coach ticket and pocketed the money that he saved from the first class.
That's hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I'll tell you now, though, that was in the 80s when I was flying for Regent Air, and, you know, everybody had a lot of money. The economy was just moving right along. People were at just the beginning of their fame. Everybody was happy. There were no rules. Everybody still smoked and drank like fish. I mean, it wasn't like it is today. You know, gas was cheap. Milk was cheap. It was it was a party decade. So, you know, everybody was footloose and fancy free. Nowadays, it's a lot different because, you know, times are tough for a lot of people. But even though the celebrities still have a lot of money, you know, you'll notice, like, some of them are coming out from, you know, underneath their rocks to go back at, like, the old band members and things to sing again because, you know, now life is a lot more expensive than it was then. So it's not as carefree as it was on Regent Air because it was wild.
Yeah, 80s was definitely a decade of excess. You know,
oh,
there was a lot
sure.
of wealth, and it was pretty high times there. No pun intended. But
that was a good one, though. I might have to steal that.
But yeah. I mean, yeah, it was. You know, really a kind of that was kind of the situation, and Wall Street was really huge. I mean, obviously, you said Michael Milken, you know, took some of your flights as well, and I mean, you know, he was known for really big for the Wall Street before he got caught I believe it was insider trading, but yeah, I mean, it was definitely a different decade. It was a different time, different experience, and you know, people were. I think that a lot of this stuff, especially considering you wrote a book about it. Back then, it was a little bit more private. You know, I don't think that a lot of people heard a lot of the stories that happened behind the scenes.
Oh, for
nowadays,
sure.
Nowadays, there's
no
just
way.
So many leaks that, you know, that TMZ and the internet gets that we hear, you know, all the time if somebody misbehaves or something like that. And they're kind of a little bit more under a microscope than they were back then, too. So,
oh, absolutely. you know,
well,
can you imagine being, like, I don't know, Sylvester Stallone? I flew him a couple times, and you can't go to the grocery store. You can't go to the airport. You can't do really anything. I mean, because you're going to get bombarded. You know, I just think it's kind of sad. So, you know, like at Regent Air, we were not allowed to get starstruck. Like, you would get fired. And I remember one girl asking for his autograph, and she got fired as soon as we landed. They left her in New York. That was it. She didn't work the flight back.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard stories about that too. Even now, up to today, I mean, there were times where people did get fired because they asked for something or a celebrity for an autograph or something like that.
Right.
I'm trying to remember. There's quite a few stories I can remember the past couple of years. I just can't remember the details off the top of my head. But that's happened before. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean it. Yeah. So you know, and I mean back then it wasn't as big of a deal to you know. Obvious to get fired, I don't think. And again, you know, that just turns up to the social media culture and the internet culture because once that story gets out, then, you know, people are going to start saying, you know, why didn't you, you know, why did you do that? And asking people, why did you fire her just for asking that question? So yeah, it's kind of an interesting situation there too.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was going to ask you about the idea. What was probably the weirdest request that you've probably had during a flight?
Okay, my weirdest story was. Okay, this was a commercial building company out of Van Nuys. When I started out of Van Nuys in Burbank, and then because I live in Huntington Beach, then I worked my way down to Long Beach and Orange County and Palomar, and I got enough work out of Long Beach to keep me there for the last 15 years, which worked great for me. But it was I think it was McGuire Cushman, and one of their wives was a second wife. And she had stolen the husband, and this is how this stuff really works. She had stolen the husband from the first wife, so she didn't like me off the bat, because if you're a second wife, this is as a general rule, you don't want a hot young flight attendant on your flight, okay, on your private jet. So then she brought on the way, we went to Nantucket, I think, and on the way back, she brought steak tartare. Now, I had no idea what steak tartare was. My dad was an LAPD officer. I didn't know what steak tartare was. And she had all this stuff in these bags from this, you know, that famous deli in New York. Or maybe we had gone to Nantucket to New York. I think we did, actually. And that's why, because she had to pick up that food or something like that. Anyways, so I go up and ask pilots what's steak tartare. They don't know. So I, you know, and I don't have cell phones. It's too, you know, way before cell phones. And so I just crumbled all the meat up in a ball, put it in a bowl, and put all the other little ingredients like the egg and the capers and the onions and all of that in little ramekins, little side dishes, and set it out like that. And she had a conniption fit. Like, I never flew with her ever again. And I said, I'm sorry, I didn't know how to serve it. And I didn't know that wasn't right. I mean, to me, that made sense. But no, you're supposed to mix it all together with the raw meat. And I didn't know. And it was really awkward, because then we had 5 hours of a flight to go, and she wouldn't even speak to me. And as the years went on, I did fly the husband, but only when the wife wasn't on board. That was funny.
Yeah, you got to
remember
that. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, but the celebrities were were the awesome ones. I mean, like, do you remember Dom DeLuise?
Yeah, I remember him.
Okay, well, so I was researching for the book because I had him on a Burt Reynolds charter. We did a 5-day charter for Burt Reynolds. We did a lot of charters. Like, I did Larry Flint for president, a presidential campaign charter with Larry Flint. And he made us all wear his T-shirts that said Larry Flint for president. It was really odd. I flew Don King on a charter, and that was really fun, way fun. And but anyway, so Dom DeLuise, you know, when I was researching, they had to insure the movies to go over budget because it would take people so long to stop laughing. So in order to recover and begin to film again, it would take, you know, an extra 20 minutes because he was so funny. Well, I have to tell you that I have never laughed so hard in my life all the way across the country with Dom DeLuise. 5 hours of solid on. He was on the entire time. And just hilarious. I mean, his antics, there's a really good story in the book about him. It was just so funny. So, you know, those kind of people were my fave, you know, because it was like, you know, you're laughing. You're not supposed to be work. This is work. That was nothing like work. We had a great time. And then they brought us all. We went down when Burt Reynolds owned the charter, the Tampa Bay Bandits football team, and we all went down to Tampa Bay. So, and they took us to the game with them, and they invited us out to dinner. It was like we hung out with the celebrities, which, you know, does not happen today. So that's a good story. And then I had Dean Martin in a stateroom with his manager, and he was hiding from everybody on the plane, but Milton Berle found out he was on there, and Milton Berle was just nuts. And at first, my first problem with Milton was he wouldn't put out his cigar, which he had always I think in his left hand, but I'm not sure. And with like one hand always had a cigar in it, and he kept lighting it up. Well, even in the 80s, you can't smoke a cigar on airplanes. So I finally got him to put it out because the purser told him that if he didn't put it out, he was going to get removed from the aircraft, and he didn't want that. And he was with his wife, and, you know, he just wouldn't listen to me. So finally he put it out. Then after the meal service, oh, wait, first Dean Martin's manager told me to make sure you keep Milton Berle out of Dean Martin's stateroom because we don't want him to know that he's on the plane because, you know, because he loves Dean Martin. He's not going to leave him alone. They used to hang out together. But at this time, Dean Martin was, well, he was tipsy and he was frail and it was after his son died, so he didn't look really, like, he didn't have a lot of happiness in his eyes. Like, he looked like something was bothering him. And he was, you know, kind of, you know, tipsy or way tipsy, actually. But anyway, so after the meal service, Milton Berle, you know, wanders around the airplane and he peeks into that curtain of that stateroom and he's in Dean Martin's stateroom with his manager. And so I go in to intervene and Milton Berle looks at me and he doesn't even hear what I'm saying and looks at me and says, "Do you know that I have the biggest schlong you've ever had, like you've ever seen?" And now you got to remember, I'm like 24 years old or something. I'm like, schlong? Is a schlong what I think it is? Then he turned around back to Dean, and he had unbuckled and unzipped, and then he turned around to me, and he dropped everything right in front of me. So did you know that he had a reputation for that?
I know he had a reputation for cross-dressing, but I don't think I remember.
That was a big rumor around Hollywood for years. I was just not on a L.A. radio station a couple weeks ago, and they were, yeah, we all heard. They all knew that, and I hadn't known it. And I, you know, even when I only learned it when I was researching for the book that was what he was known for. I always thought it was Uncle Milty or Mr. Television because, you know, he was the reason that we sold so many TVs in the 20s or 30s or whenever it was. But anyways, yeah, he dropped it. And anyways, to be honest with you, the thing was darn huge, and the rumor's true. So there's those kind of stories. And then there's the ones with Tom Cruise and Rod Stewart and Lionel Richie, and I had President Reagan. And I just had an odd, eclectic collection of the rich and famous.
Was there just one particular celebrity where you just awestruck that you were going to be a part of, being the attendant of the flight with that person?
That I would what? Be a part of what? I'm sorry.
I mean, was there one celebrity that you were really, really, you know, awestruck that you were going
to be? Oh, yeah, that would have been, well, first Dean Martin, because I really, really think, well, Dean Martin, I was very awestruck because, you know, I mean, he's the Rat Pack, okay? And my mom and dad used to play his music all the time. When we were cruising around our boathouse, we would just listen to him on all the Rat Pack. So that was one. But my other one really was Jack Nicholson. He was just such a joy. He was such a cool guy. He's like the most authentic dude you have ever met. Like, you can tell he doesn't give a crap what anybody thinks of him. So, and then, you know, he used to wear his signature Ray-Ban sunglasses, his wafers, and they would match his socks. So every flight he was on, either his socks matched his Ray-Bans or his Ray-Bans matched his socks, but that's how he dressed. And he always sat in the bar car in that one corner in the bar car because that's where he liked to watch the activity, and he chatted with us all. He was just a joy to be around. And the first time I had him in my section, I really thought he wanted me to be his lunch that day because he's just got this underlying sex appeal thing that, you know, that I don't really even think he tries to do. It just kind of comes off on him. It's just this vibe he sends out, you know, and then he looks at you and he would put his hand on my arm just like a tad longer than needed to be there, you know, so you couldn't like break the connection. And it was weird because I was like, is he flirting with me or is this just how he is, right? And then his lips curl up at the sides, and when he looks at you, you're just like, wow. You know, I can't tell if he's just being himself or he's flirting with you. You can't tell. So, yeah, he was one of my main ones. Jack and Dean were the ones that I was the most starstruck with. Tom was great, too. Tom Cruise was wonderful, but his producers were not, and that made it a really tough charter. That was a really tough flight. I worked really, really hard on that flight. So I didn't have much time to admire him, but I did because he actually helped me because I was so I was overloaded with work. I had a full airplane, like 14, there were either 12 or 14 people, and everybody was shouting for things at once. And what happens on a private jet, you know, is you have a galley that's the size of a hall closet on the older ones. The newer ones are not that small. But, and then you might have six different food requests or eight or 12 on a one-hour flight. Well, you got to serve all those people. Then you got to clear all those dishes. You got to refill, if it's morning, this was coffee. You have to refill coffees. Then you got to take away all the placemats and the cutlery. And then, you know, by the time you get to the last guy, you're on descent. Well, you need to eat in a hurry, dude, because I got to pick that right back up. So it was, and then I got to secure all the dishes because you can't land with glass flying through the cabin. So you have to, like, I mean, literally I was throwing things in the galley to get them put away before the wheels hit the tarmac. And Tom actually got up and helped me. And I think he did it as a joke. What?
I was going to say, obviously both doing a private jet versus versus the commercial airline has its perks and it has its problems.
Exactly. Like, that was the only flight that I really considered work because at that time, and again, this was a long time ago, but I really felt like it was the rich who weren't famous that were the jerks in the world. Because the famous people, almost all of them are really nice, but not all. There's some in the book that weren't, and I told the truth.
Yeah, now, I think, what was I going to say? Oh, I was going to ask you what Jack's favorite drink was when he was up with you.
So you know, I think it was whiskey, but I'm not positive. It seems to me it was Jack. But I don't remember. Like, I remember Dean's was scotch neat with a soda back in a bottle because I couldn't wait to serve him. But with Jack, I'm not positive. I'm pretty sure it was whiskey. I think it was Jack Daniels.
I mean,
I know it was
a dark liquid.
I remember that. I'm just not positive on what it was, but I'm pretty sure it was whiskey. And see, he would fly with us because he was following the LA Lakers to the New York Knicks when they were in the playoffs.
Yeah. Now I was going to ask about the bar too. I mean, obviously, you have to have a certain stock bar or whatever. On a private jet, I think it's a little bit easier because, I mean, obviously, there's going to be requests before you guys take off. But I mean, obviously, on the charter airline, you obviously had to have, you only probably had certain kinds of alcohol on board, I'm assuming.
Yes, and that's true. And you can get stuck. I did run out of vodka once, and we were going to Italy, and we had a mechanical had to stop in New York for not very long to get something fixed. And thank God for me because I sent one of the rampers, the guys that come out to the airplane to get your trash and fuel you and all that. I gave him, I don't even remember, $100, I think, and said, go get me vodka and get me lots of it because I didn't know that all 12 people were going to drink vodka. So usually you'll have, you know, I knew those passengers, and I knew like 8 of them drank vodka, but they were ready to party, man, and they drank 2 bottles on the way to New York from Long Beach. And I thought that was enough to get me all the way to Italy. Not so much. But, yeah, you can't. Oh, Eddie Van Halen and David Lee Roth drank every beer we had on Regent Air, which was a ton because I kept going in the back and putting more in the back of the galley and putting more beer on the ice. And they drank it all. I mean, that's hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, was the Italy flight the longest flight you've probably been on?
No. Okay, here's the longest. And I just was telling somebody this the other day. We were in Caracas, Venezuela for a meeting with, like, national companies. I was flying for a very well-known company that I can't say. And, like, everybody was there, like American Express and, you know, lots of major car companies and major banks. And there was just a lot of people there. And so it was interesting because there's a lot of private jet crews at this one hotel. I think it was the Sheraton. But, you know, usually we stay at Marriott's because we all collect points. But some people collect other points, like Hilton points or Embassy Suites, which they like because you get free cocktails in the afternoon. some people like Starwoods because they get the nicer, you know, the Westins and the Regencies and all that, or Regent. But we at the time usually stayed at, almost all of us stayed at Marriott's at that time. And then we would try to find a JW. And unless you went international. Now, international, my favorite boss I worked for years and years and years would always put us up in the same hotel he was at because he didn't want us to get sick. So if we were going to Egypt or Australia, we stayed where he did, which was really cool, you know, because you're in this six-star resort going, yeah, okay, this does not suck, right? This is awesome. And I'm getting paid daily to sit here and go to the beach in Australia. I mean, it was great. But so anyways, we were in Caracas. We had to leave and go to D.C., Washington, D.C., which in itself is about, I think, a five-hour flight, four and a half maybe. And then we sat in D.C. while he went to a meeting for 4 hours. Then we flew to Anchorage. The pilots got off. I did not. We got fresh pilots in Anchorage, and then we flew all the way to Narita, Japan. And that was my longest day. And I don't remember exactly, but I think it was 22 hours. So
at least you had a little bit of a break in that 4 hours in D.C.
Yeah, you need to sleep. The problem is, you know, I had probably just gotten up and only worked 4.5-5 hours to get there. I wasn't tired. But I'm sure that I laid down and read my book and maybe slept. I don't remember. Sometimes, you know how you think you might be sleeping, but you're reading, who knows. And then from there to Anchorage, I worked because I had to serve dinner. And then after Anchorage, I would make the beds up and they would go to sleep. Now, there were times, depending on how many people I had on board, I could sit. There's usually a seat or two that are inconspicuous in the back right next to the galley. So if it's not a full flight, you can sit back there if the passengers don't mind. And, again, it depends on your passengers and what kind of – if it's a charter or an owner-operated or whatnot. I almost always sit in that seat so I can hear them if they get up, and I can curl up in a ball and sleep in those seats. Okay, so I used to do that unless it was inappropriate, like – with foreign companies, depending on their language, like with the Japanese, it's not appropriate. You can't do that. So with the Japanese, I would go shut the cabin door and sleep on the floor between the pilots and the cabin door, which was freezing because the main cabin door is right there, and it, you know, any aircraft door, it doesn't seal, even though they're airtight, they still get cold up there because there's no heating vents. So I would line all the coats up on that side of the drape that was in front of the main cabin door, and then put my UGG boots on and my hat and my gloves and my coat and even leg warmers because it was that cold. And then I would sleep flat so I didn't get all wrinkled. And then, you know, if worse comes to worse, then you have your jump seat that's in between the pilots. And that's the most uncomfortable thing in the world to sleep in. And on some planes, there's a jump seat in the galley. At least you can sit down on really long flights. But, like, if you're flying with somebody where you have to stay in the cabin, but you can't sleep, then you have to sit in that jump seat in the galley because they want to be able to see you. So it just depends. And one time I was flying Roger Penske on a smaller Challenger coming back from Australia. That was a really long flight because that plane – only can make it to American Samoa for fuel from Sydney to American Samoa for fuel, which was beautiful, one of the most stunning airports I've ever landed in. And then from there we went to Honolulu where we got fresh pilots, and again I kept going. But from American Samoa to Honolulu, I sat on top of the briefcases in the hall closet because there was no place for me to lay down on that plane. It was too small. And you can't sleep in a jump seat. It's impossible. So I slept sitting up with my head against the wall on the briefcases. And it was the most uncomfortable sleep in my life, but I didn't care. I was so exhausted that I slept on them anyways, and I did sleep.
So after the 22-hour flight, I mean, how long did you stay in Tokyo? Was it a quick trip back, or did you have actually some time in Tokyo?
Usually it depends. If you, in that era, we used to go ahead and fly back empty, which is called deadheading. So we might be dropping passengers off and turning around and heading back to home, which meant it was only my pilots and myself on the airplane, which was awesome. because I'd bring us movies and I'd make cookies and I'd make them tuna melts and I'd do cartwheels up and down the airplane and I'd blare music and we just had a ball. I'd give them back rubs, you know, because you're on autopilot most of the time. Or we'd play Trivial Pursuit. We did that. We played cards. I watched a lot of movies and slept a lot is what I did because I wasn't really needed. And I cleaned the airplane. I did clean the airplane, like, thoroughly, like, detailed it. I would do that first. Then when I burn out, then I would lay down and sleep and then get up and, give you know, make them food. And Hot Fudge Sundays, I did a lot of those. But if we had passengers, they would always give us 3 days to recover, which was really nice because, when you're young, you recover by day two. You know, nowadays it would take me 3 days to recover. So usually, you know, you spend one day sleeping, then you get up and I was always like the first one out of my room. Where are we going? What are we seeing? Let's go see something. Let's go on a tour. Let's go on a bike ride. Let's go on a hike. I used to rollerblade. I almost got arrested for rollerblading on the Imperial Palace grounds because they're sacred. Who knew? I got to see something. I don't care if it's something that we eat, something that's I can only whatever you can only find in that country. I want to see.
Okay, then what was your favorite country to visit then?
Oh, okay, that's a really tough question. If you want peaceful and relaxing, Fiji is awesome. But if you want a country that's really got it together and is a very unique place to visit, is Singapore.
Yeah, I mean, well, the thing with Singapore, too, is the fact that, you know, I think it's very – they keep it very, very clean.
It's
I guess it's
very clean. Well, they don't sell chewing gum.
Yeah.
You know, and they are strict. Everybody's read about how strict
they
are.
It's legal to have it, too, so, yeah, yeah.
But if you get a DUI in Singapore, they put an amber light on your car and it goes around at all times. So
yeah,
they know that
they are,
you're a potential drunk driver. Yeah,
it's a great place to visit, but just know there's a lot of restrictions. It's the opposite of here in Vegas, pretty much.
Oh, by far the opposite. There are a gazillion rules.
Uh-huh. So yeah. Speaking of which.
Yeah.
I would be remiss to not ask you about, I mean, obviously there's got to have been times where you've flown into McCarran and you know, what.
Oh, many.
I mean, you know, obviously a lot of, there's very few times where it's not about either performing or B, going on vacation. What's it been like for you to have passengers come into McCarran?
I had Kenny Loggins go in there for a concert, and the wife got us tickets before we even landed. And I think we went, but then we had to leave because we had an early morning flight departure. I flew a lot of people to see Celine Dion, a lot of people. I flew people in for a lot of bachelor parties, for tons of bachelor parties. Tons of bachelorette parties for, like, the owner's wife or the owner's daughter. I flew conventions, especially the big convention there, the electronic one.
What? I know what you're talking about. I kind of blanked at what it was named.
You know what I mean, though. That big electronic show, the consumer show, it's huge. But there were times I would been called six times to do a trip to Vegas, and I always book the first one. I mean, the first person that calls me, I go, which is kind of a bummer because, like, one time I got called to fly the L.A. Lakers. I got called to fly the L.A. Lakers when they were playing the Phoenix Suns in a playoff, and then I got called to go to Turks and Caicos and sit for 7 days. But I had already committed to the Lakers, so I couldn't go because that's how this business is. But anyways, yeah, many, many flights to Vegas, a lot of flights to Vegas. I've flown people there for boxing matches. I've flown, just literally tons of them. There are all kinds of them. So, and, you know, it's one of our favorite destinations. Who doesn't want to go to Vegas? Of course I want to go to Vegas. It's a 45-minute flight. What's the worst they could do to me? The worst that they can do to me on that Vegas flight is have full food, which is always something that I would preheat, pre-wrapped, like an egg burrito or something like that, or bagels and cream cheese, and I would already have them pre-wrapped and in the oven. So all I had to do was take them out and put them on a plate, and then, you know, I mean, before we were even at a, you know, a safe attitude, meaning the airplane fly straight, I'd pull up their chair, their tables, pull out their tables, set them up, and I don't care if their stuff is sliding. You ask for a meal service on a 45-minute flight, you're getting fed while you're on ascent. Then I would, you know, refill their drinks because they're going to Vegas, so everybody's drinking, and then, you know, put it away as fast as possible. But usually all they said is they wanted a snack, which is really easy. You put a basket of, you know, pastries, Danishes, muffins, and maybe some bagels, and pass around the basket with plates, and that would be it, usually. But, you know, everybody's drinking Bloody Marys, and I got really – my Bloody Marys were really good, and screwdrivers and mimosas, if it's – almost always. You know, unless it's a night flight. But most of these people don't want to get there at night. They leave in the morning, and they leave early.
Of course, they want to get there early enough to start partying and all that as well and kind of,
exactly.
You know,
because they don't care about price, so their hotel room's ready. They don't have to wait like the rest of us till 2 o'clock to check in.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and there's always that gap. I hate that gap between when you have to check out and check in. That's just
oh, I know. It's awful.
That's awful. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, this obviously was a great life for you. You were able to travel the world and see some of the more famous people out there as well. I mean, you know, it's great to be able to hear some of these stories and all that as well. I mean, you know, but it sounds like you had a lot of fun, you know, all the way through this as well. So it's great to be able to see what kind of stories you have in this book. And, yeah, I mean, you know, be able to hear that. Why did you, one last question, why did you decide to get out of, I mean, are you still out of the business?
Well, you know what, I have bad feet. I had what you call Morton's neuromas, and they're pinched nerves in each foot, and it's from flying around the world in high heels. My mistake, I should have known, but you know what, I was vain, I was young, and I was wearing my high heels on. So I had my foot surgery done in 2008, and that's when I wrote the book. I went to Hawaii to recuperate and start jogging down to my tree because my parents have a condo in Hawaii and all that, and I did exactly what the podiatrist said, and when I was jogging the very first day, my right foot opened, and it started bleeding. So, but it wasn't the stitches at the top. It was the ones at the bottom where the vein had been removed, so nobody would touch it. So I couldn't get an emergency room, a hospital, anybody. I went to 4 different places and nobody would touch it. So my podiatrist was on vacation and there was nothing they could do for me. So now I have severe scar tissue in each foot because I couldn't walk on them because it would bleed. So anyways, I have bad feet. So, and you know what? I'm older now, and let's be honest, they hire young, hot chicks just like when they hired me. And, you know, nowadays I've kind of aged out. So, I mean, I could probably still do it if I wanted to, but my feet are so bad, I don't think it would be wise. So, anyways, I sat on the book for a while. I tried to get it published. I had an agent, I had a publisher, and they said it was too nice and it wasn't trashy enough. But if it was trashy, they could sell it immediately. But then I found a couple more publishers, and then they would take out my humor, and I finally just said, you know what, I'm going to do this myself because I can. And so I did, and that's why it's on Amazon, and I'm trying to get it to airport bookstores and made into a movie and maybe a TV series because it's hilarious. So I'm like, we'll see where it takes me.
Yeah, definitely will. I mean, like I said, it's an interesting life, definitely, to be able to do that as well. You know, an interesting career, as it were, too. So it's great to be able to see that as well. Anything else you want to add?
Oh, you know, just if you ever wonder what a private jet's really like, it's all in there. I explain to you how to, you know, what the interiors are like, what the galleys are like, what the pilots are like, what the layovers are like, you know, all the weird stuff that happened along the way, and all the benefits, you know, of like getting, you know, front row seats to the hot Las Vegas shows. We did that a lot. I got a lot of shows, and Broadway shows and Las Vegas shows. But, you know, like I saw the two guys, Siegfried and Roy, there at least 6 times because everybody kept giving us tickets to those. And all, you know, the weird stuff that you would never think about that happens, you know, like when the airplane breaks down at the end of the runway and you've got 14 jets behind you, like that's not good. And the drunks, those are all in there. And, you know, the just all the bizarre stuff on top of all the celebrities. And, again, there's Rod Stewart and Lionel Richie and Elizabeth Taylor, who let one of the girls wear her corrupt diamond the whole flight. I wore Dionne Warwick's mink coat the whole flight. So there's, like, the gamut of everything of what it's really like to fly in a private jet. It's all in that book.
Yeah, I want to mention you can follow Patricia on Twitter at Flying Celebrity. You guys can go to the website jetsettingsecrets.com to check out some stuff over there as well. And like I said, the new book is
wrong. Those are wrong. I'm sorry,
okay.
That's an old website. It's Private Jet Tales. Twitter at Private Jet Tales.
Private Jet Tales. Got you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was an old publisher, and I thought I had everything taken down. Apparently, I didn't. So it's Private Jet Tells at Twitter, and then Facebook is Flying with the Rich and Famous. Instagram is Flying with the Rich and Famous. Google Plus is Patricia Reed. What are we missing? Pinterest is Patricia Reed and Flying with the Rich and Famous. And the only one that's Private Jet Tells is Twitter.
So there you go. You can follow her and ask her questions if you want and all that as well. And like I said, go to Amazon. Please get the book, Flying with the Rich and Famous, by Patricia Reed. Patricia, really great time being able to talk to you a little bit about what's been what's going on in terms of your career. I really hope your feet are a little bit better, and hopefully this book starts to take off a little bit, as they say.
Yeah, no, it is. It's doing really well. I'm surprised. You know, I knew people would want to read it because it's a genre that's never been done, but I didn't expect it to do quite as well as it is. So yeah, it's doing well. It's not a great book, but it's a good book.
Well, yeah. Best of luck to you. I really hope that this kind of does lead to something as well. And like I said, absolute pleasure to be able to talk to you a little bit about
you
your job
too,
and
my
the,
dear.
Your experiences.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, not at all. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, hon. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. That was Patricia Reed, everybody. Like I said, please check out her book on Amazon, Flying with the Rich and Famous. You can also find that on Facebook as well, so make sure you guys check that out as well. Next week, I think we have an actor coming on. Give me a double check on that for you. We have a really cool actor coming on to talk with us. We have some really good guests coming up because we're kind of starting to get booked. One of our favorite comedians will be back on Sean Pulaski. She'll be back on in March, I believe March 15th. I think I have her earmarked for. She is in a movie called Try. It'll be her first serious role, and we always love it when Sean Pulaski comes back on with us as well. So that'll happen in March. We have a gal that's give me one second here, and I will take a look and see who we have on next week. Come on. Give me one second here. I'm going to think over here. Come on. Actor Sam Quinn will be on this with us next week. He's going to be in a new movie called Jane's Got a Gun with Natalie Portman, Ewan McGregor. The trailer for the movie is currently out right now, so you guys can check that out. I saw the trailer when I was watching Hateful Eight, but definitely check out the trailer. And then we'll have Sam Quinn with us next week. And he's also going to be Independence Day Resurgence coming out this summer, too. So we'll have actor Sam Quinn on next week. Like I said, Sean Pulaski is going to be on coming in March. Let's see here. One more person I think I have coming in. I'm going to go ahead and look that up real quick. Because I have her. I think I earmarked her for March. So she's going to be a really cool gal. I think she's a relationship expert. Let me double check here. Let me take a look. Allison Blackman from the Advice Sisters. I wanted to get her on this week, but she is actually heading back from Germany. So she's going to be on in March, probably that same day as there as well. I also want to mention that by the looks of it, we are going to be doing a live podcast at some point over at the Artemis Film Festival in L.A. coming up in April. We'll have more information about that coming up in the upcoming weeks. Please follow us on Twitter at SWIV, at SWIV, that stands for Somewhere in Vegas, Somewhere in Vegas on Facebook, and VegasPodcasting.com, which I need to update all with all the guests that we have. But we have a bunch of guests coming on the next couple of weeks. We'll have Sam Quinn on next week. We'll have some guests the week after it. We've got a lot of demand, definitely, for this podcast. So we'll be probably booked pretty solidly for the next month or so. So definitely check us out. Check us out on the social media websites, and we'll have an update on that as well. With that in mind, we'll see you guys next week at 1 o'clock Pacific and 4 p.m. Eastern with actor Sam Quinn. Maybe we have another guest on as well on a Throwback Thursday, throwback interview as well. We'll talk to you guys then.